Well, first of all, belatedly, I'd like to wish everyone a happy 4th of July. My flag is still out from yesterday because I forgot to bring it in, especially after it rained and it was wet. So I think all of us make those mistakes. In our first reading today from Ezekiel, a later one of the prophets, it's not exactly an advertisement that people are going to respond to. I'm calling you to be a prophet and people are going to hate you. It's not exactly what we're looking for in our life. We want to be comfortable. There's an article in last week's Washington Post by a professor at Wellesley College talking about the way in which colleges are being undermined because they're business-driven now. They want to give people what they want, not what they need. Nobody's interested in education. They're interested only in getting a job. So therefore, what happens? Do you realize there are only two colleges in the United States with English departments right now that still require a course in Shakespeare? And one of them, by the way, is the United States Naval Academy. I was pleased to learn that at least the midshipmen are running something. So therefore, it's a matter of, he's going to go among hostile people. There's no promise of good wages or anything like that, time off. Then we come to 2 Corinthians. Paul sort of fits into this too because he reminds the people, I'm not elated, even though I've been blessed with all these other revelations that I have, because he's talking about these prophets that go around drawing crowds to themselves. The analogy I used to use was like the television evangelicals, but they've pretty much disappeared now. You know, it's just a flash in the pan that lasted maybe 20 years. And Paul's reminding them, I've been preserved from this by a thorn in my side. Nobody knows what it is. One commentator years ago said that perhaps it was depression that he suffered from. And yet, nevertheless, Paul continues even though he feels as though he's not getting anywhere. Paul never had any doubts about who he was. That's why you've heard me say before, I would not want to have dinner with him. I would thoroughly enjoy having dinner with Peter, but I would never use good china. But nevertheless, Peter, what we know most about is he keeps sinning and keeps picking himself up. He wouldn't make it in the United States. Because after all, each one of us knows we're perfect. I'll come back to that. Now Mark's Gospel, picking up really from Ezekiel, that's what ties it together liturgically today. Jesus goes back to his own home country and preaches in the synagogue. And what's the response? Well, where did he get this from? Isn't this the son of Mary? Isn't this the carpenter? Don't we know his family? By the way, the terms brothers and sisters, for years Protestant exegetes would argue that this was an argument against the perpetual virginity of the Virgin Mary. In a more ecumenical age, about 40 years ago, my friend Joe Fitzmaier was on this committee and said, we should look at this. And it was all the Protestants who put him down. Because the trouble is, it goes back to the Aramaic where there's no verbal distinction between a blood relative and a sibling, brother or sister. It's the same word used for cousin or for blood brother. So therefore, it's no longer an issue. But nevertheless, what's important there is that he's not recognized in his own country. He's in exile, if you will. And in many ways, all of us have to be in exile permanently. If we start feeling comfortable, we're probably not listening to the gospel. So today I'd like to talk, as you would suspect, the nature of prophecy, first of all, and then Jesus as a prophet, and Jesus in his own hometown, and then to apply this to the United States, especially when we're celebrating this weekend of the anniversary of our independence. Because there's a danger of thinking of, we are a blessed nation. The greatest danger from the beginning, the founding of Massachusetts, was to think of the United States or the new colonies as an elect nation, better than all the others. Incidentally, just in passing, New England, for the Puritans, had a religious, the term was a religious one, because they saw England as the new elect nation, the new Israel, with a destiny to fill the world and all this kind of stuff. And then what they did is they took the elect of the elect nation and formed New England from those who knew they were saved. There's a certain danger to that, but we'll come back to it. Okay, first of all, the nature of prophecy. I apologize. Either I have a summer cold or a lousy allergy. I finally took a labor this morning to see how it kicks in. The nature of prophecy. I've said this before. It comes from the two Greek words, prophemi, to speak in behalf of. Ezekiel gives us a clue. The prophet speaks in behalf of God. You're going to have false prophets. Those are the ones who speak in behalf of themselves. The crowd pleasers, those who believe in the cult of personality, which of course is probably the greatest virtue of the American church today. and we really go for the last little dollop of what makes us feel good. He speaks in behalf of God. Is he going to be popular? Not according to the job description in Ezekiel. He's probably going to alienate even the people of God who've already alienated themselves from God. They don't want to hear the man speaking in behalf of God. They've turned away from God already, and yet they're the chosen people. So Ezekiel sent to them to speak in behalf of God, not to win a popularity contest. The second point, though, Jesus, and also a little bit of Mark here. Jesus goes into his own town, and they don't want him because somehow or other he's not what they're expecting. They cannot get past the appearances. They're like so many of us today. Let's not just leave it back in the first century. It's like so many of us today that we judge by appearances and not by what the message is. Instead of listening to what he said, they said, where did he get all this? I've had people ask that. Where did you learn all this? Well, I went to school for one thing. You know, that's a matter of education sometimes. Actually, it was Walter Sullivan who said that to me once. Where did you learn all that? It was a course in theology I took. Paul knows that he's not popular. And he's trying to warn the people against these other ecstatic prophets, those who stand up, and they really are crowd learners. They get people around behind them. Paul had a speech impediment of some type. We know this from some of the other writings, where he talks about he was not a good speaker. He tried to go into Athens one time. He thought for sure he'd win them over. He failed because they decided they'd build another little temple to this God he was preaching. Of course, he was preaching about Christ, the risen one, the ultimate revelation of the Father. That didn't go over well with the Greeks at the time. And certainly it showed that he was weak. But it also points out where he stood, because he wrote it down and talked about his failings. It's not something that people want to do today. That somehow or other, when Jesus went back to his own hometown, they judged him by the human appearance. Paul, who begins to, after all, remember, Paul was a Pharisee. He was a trained rabbi, the only one with any education among the apostles. And he never knew Jesus of Nazareth. He was a witness to the risen Christ. And he's the one who, though a Jew in his whole core being, nevertheless, he's the one who goes out to the Gentiles, the non-Jews, people like our ancestors for the most part. The third and final point. I already alluded to part of it. We are a very blessed nation, I think. And I certainly could not be anything else but an American. By the way, in writing, until recently, I've been writing something recent again. And you always have to say the United States. It always sounded awkward to me to say the United States bishops are. And what was wrong with America? Well, all of a sudden, it shifted back again. And this was sensitivity, the fact that there's only one country in the world, by the way, in the Western world, that has America as part of its official title. There was, until recently, the United States of Mexico and the United States of Brazil. So therefore, simply to say United States was not sufficient. But nevertheless, that's what the preferred editorial thing was. And I've been noticing how much it's changed now. So I said, I could never have been anything but an American, but I recognize too the danger of being overly nationalistic, of judging the whole world by what we do. I just finished writing a paper for the Vatican. There's a symposium next December. They wanted a text by June. And one of the things was, it's on the American participation, and the Americans went and they didn't quite understand some things. For one thing, the language of the council was Latin, and very few of the bishops spoke Latin. That's when people want to go back to the good old days of Latin. How many have ever spoken Latin? My oral exams were still in Latin, but that was the last generation. No, younger Jesuits wouldn't know Latin that way. We were supposed to speak only Latin in our houses as well. Didn't work too well. It's lousy Latin. But nevertheless, one of the things was the Americans had to learn a different way of understanding things. Not just language, but ways of understanding. And there's a dangerous set of being nationalistic, imposing our will on other people. But then there's also a danger right now. Out of curiosity, there's a danger of watering down the gospel to win people over. That's part of the message in today's gospel. But just for America magazine is taking a poll right now. How many have read the new encyclical? Okay, well, it's a long read, And of course, it's very unpopular because it doesn't fit in with the mainstream American ethos. Somebody asked me before it came out, where did he ever get this idea? I said, well, maybe the Holy Spirit. If we do not want to be like the people in Nazareth, maybe we have to stand back and say, if we're hearing something that we don't agree with, it may be because it's correct. Maybe. And there's a lot of things in the encyclical. One of the things I noticed as I was going through it, I thought, where do you get these footnotes from? And I went and looked. They're mainly from Episcopal conferences. He's showing the consensus of the church throughout the world. To my knowledge, it's the first time an encyclical has ever quoted from a statement of bishops' conferences. So already there's something else going on. And it includes the Americans, by the way. The Americans have had very strong positions on this, but I dare say most people are unaware of it. You have to get the Vatican Information Service every morning like I do, and then these other things, because that's my job. But one of the things is there are a lot of things in there. The failure of us for many generations to recognize that we are in charge of all creation to tend it, not to destroy it. So that's something that the Native Americans somewhat recognized. It's something, by the way, the first person that Francis quotes in this encyclical is the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Bartholomew of Constantinople. Rather interesting. That's the first time that any encyclical has quoted an Eastern Rite patriarch, because they're on the same page on this. Do we agree with everything? No. But are we open to listening to it, or do we decide it doesn't fit into the American economy? That's where our nationalism can get in the way. Now, there's some things, I think, that, for instance, he challenges the use of air conditioning. Well, I don't think he spent a summer in Charlottesville. I wouldn't be able to get any work done if I didn't have air conditioning. There are a number of other things we may quibble with. But maybe it's also a spark to our own sense of our obligations to the world within which we live, not only because of taking care of nature, but after all, nature is what provides the source of nourishment for all these other people. It's very easy when you look at the consumption in the United States over against the rest of the world, like oil. We consume much more than anybody else. Can we cut back? Okay, we're working on it, I think. But nevertheless, simply to dismiss these things. By the way, the first time an encyclical was challenged was 1961. It was on social justice, Mater et Magistra, mother and teacher. And a number of people, mainly very reactionary Catholics, said, Mater si, Magistra non. Mother, yes, but teacher, no. So this is a public dissent from an encyclical by people who claim they were more in the know than the Pope was. This is not to say that popes are always right, and this is not infallible. Nevertheless, before rejecting it, I think it's good for us to pause and say, are we listening for the word of God, or are we listening for what we want to hear? Are we looking for something that makes us feel good, or that challenges us to do better? As soon as we feel comfortable as Catholics, we're probably not paying attention. But it doesn't mean that we wallow in guilt, but rather we're like Peter. I goofed again. Let's get going. So our readings today talk about the nature of prophecy, speaking in behalf of God, not in behalf of the person speaking. And then we see that Jesus, he was a prophet, but where did that get him? His own people rejected him, as his own people rejected Ezekiel. That's the nature of prophecy, not to be popular, but to speak in behalf of God. And today in the United States, we should recognize all the blessings we have and our obligation to share, in terms of which, before we reject this recent encyclical, it might be good to read it. This is one of the hardest things I have getting my students to do in the university, to get them to read, to go to the library. And by the way, I got an invitation from the National Geographic Society to get a facsimile version of the Declaration of Independence. Do you realize that the overwhelming majority of high school graduates today could not read it? You know why? It's in cursive. I didn't think that made a difference until a Jesuit friend of mine with a master's in English said, do you realize I wrote notes to the kids in my parish and they couldn't read it? Does it mean they cannot read any of these documents anymore? until everything was printed. So in other words, they can read anything from the 20th century on, but not earlier. He said, you know the kind of stuff you do wallowing in archives where everything is handwritten? It's a lost art. So therefore, we have to be careful that even the way in which we shape our opinions is being more and more and more limited. So our message today is to recognize, ultimately, that we have been very blessed as a nation. And that means we also have an obligation. We may not like what's coming out of Rome, but maybe we should read it and find out what it is that is it is saying. And again, I want to wish you a happy, belated 4th of July.